The talk, Developing Sangha. Order members, mitras and friends. I was asked by Miles if I would give the talk after suggesting the theme of the weekend to him. It's a theme that has grown in my own life and now holds a very special place there. When we look at the poster, we get some idea, you know, of what strength the Sangha can be seen by some. That very big lotus, a big red lotus over East Anglia. But I think maybe we should look at it as a very big lotus, you know, resting all over the world as we know it, this troubled world that we live in. So why should there be this big lotus over the world that we know, this troubled world? Well, in a way, it's obvious. The Sangha is the lifeblood and the support that connects people to the Buddha, to the Dharma. Yeah? No Sangha, no Dharma, and no Buddha. You can read that the other way around. No Buddha, no Dharma, and then no Sangha. But today, no Sangha, no Dharma, and no Buddha. It's the survival of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Yeah, that's what developing Sangha is about. So what did the Buddha say about the Sangha? He talked about the Sangha in a very important way, the time that Ananda asked him whether spiritual friendship was half of the spiritual life. And the Buddha said, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so." He said, "Spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata, is the whole of the spiritual life." It's the whole of the spiritual life. And that, you know, that quote still resonates very much with me. He also said on another occasion that in terms of survival of the Sangha, or maybe it's survival of the order, that he suggested that this would carry on if the order... If the order gathered in large numbers. Yeah? But I'd also see it, you know, in terms of the Sangha gathering large numbers. I've seen that, I've experienced it, you know, from the big international gathering to a weekend like this, you know, so from 400 people to 24 people, gathering in large numbers has an effect. So for me, where did it all start? Where did my connection with the Tri Ratna Buddhist community, then the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, start? It started in 1974 at St. Columba's Church of Scotland in Knightsbridge in London. And there we had invited an order member, one of the early order members called Chintamani, to give a talk to the Youth Fellowship. And we invited him because Jack, who ran the Youth Fellowship, saw at that time that the movement was being written of as a very forward-looking spiritual movement. And I like to think that's still the case. I believe it's still the case. So when I eventually got to his talk, I was making tea and coffee that night. What struck me was the way he put together things in a very clear way and in a way that sort of summed up my beliefs, though I'd been alone, you know, for 21 years, living my life, but I'd never heard this package being put together, and it just resonated deeply with me. And that moved me. Secondly, I had a strong feeling I was meeting an old friend. And it was those two reasons, and I think the latter, that encouraged me to ask him for his details so we could meet up. It wasn't till about a month or so later that we did meet, but 2 weeks later I went along to what was our only urban Buddhist centre, the North London Buddhist Centre, just off Dartmouth Park Hill Road in London on Balmore Street. Now when I approached that centre, what I saw on that gloomy October, November night was that there were no ground floor windows, apart from the toilet window. You couldn't see in that, thank goodness. There was no glazed door into the reception room to be able to see in what was beyond the walls. There was no outside light to brighten the threshold. There was no notice board to read the activities. So I still took my chance. Well, I wasn't expecting anything. I took my chance and walked in. Now, when I look back at that first visit and subsequent visits, I was fairly regular. What strikes me is that I met order members who wanted nothing from me. They didn't even want me to join. What they wanted was for me to be myself. That was the important thing. And that was what I wanted to be very much, in my heart, that's what I was looking for. I wanted to be myself. I knew I was carrying masks, and those masks were hindering me from enjoying life. I also, in seeing the order members interacting, I loved their communication. And, some weeks I'd see them having heated debates, maybe even call them arguments over certain points. Maybe it was just to do with what tea they bought, I'm not sure. And then the next week they'd be hugging one another. In the world I came from, to see that change so quickly was very dramatic. And I loved it. Those are my early impressions. But I suppose, like us all, in my early days and months and possibly years, I would say that I was fed. I was fed by order members and mitras, fed by good communication in the groups that I joined, and in one-to-one communication, such as the time quite early on, or times it was, after the centre activities, I'd go home on the bus to Muswell Hill with Sagaramati, who had just recently been ordained. And we got on really well, and I really valued those times with him, just as it were, talking through the evening, but also learning more about the Dharma through him, as he had a very keen mind and a great love of the Dharma, which still carries on and inspires people, makes them think, sometimes quite suddenly, about their beliefs. He doesn't take any prisoners. And also, at that time, I listened to Bhante on cassette, so that was a great feeding, a great nourishing. And I read publications. There were very few at that time. I think we had a newsletter. We had our own newsletter. And any books that came out, I'd buy those. I also joined a weekly study group. And then eventually I went on a weekend retreat. And that retreat I thoroughly enjoyed and was very sad to leave. And was envious of the order members who were staying on at Ariyatara community in Purley. So about a year after coming along, I joined a community in North London. And in that community at the time was Lokamitra, Padmapani, an order member called Luva, the only order member that I'm aware of who's been ordained by Bhante and given a name from Blake, from Blake's view of the world. A chap called Richard, and then sometimes another guy called Gary would come along. And Richard eventually became Padmavajra, who I'm sure most of you know and love. And Gary became that, well, what seems to be a successful author now, called Ratnaguna, writing his book on reflection. So by that time I was a mitra. I remember how I became a mitra. I was walking up the road with Sagaramati one day towards the centre. We must have agreed to Muswell Hill, or it was just coincidence. And I said, I'd like to become a mitra. He said, oh, I'll talk about it with the ord members. Eventually I was told in a sort of similar casual fashion. I said, well, am I a mitra? He said, yeah, you're a mitra. And that was it. I didn't have a ceremony. I don't know if I've missed out on something. But it doesn't hurt. And in those days, unlike today's criteria, the criteria that was in place was quite an interesting list. And I've been wondering whether we shouldn't revisit and discuss these criteria, because I think in their way, they could lead to helping us developing Sangha. Okay, so the first one was not shopping around. In other words, you know, you had really decided that the FWBO, Tree Ratna Buddhist Community, you know, was for you. That you're in close contact with order members, and that would come up, you know, when we were discussing somebody's readiness to be a mitra. Who did they know? What did they think? What were they like? that the proposed mitra had a daily meditation practice. And that they helped, the fourth criteria was that they helped order members. And in the background, in the later years, there was this almost a requisite to be vegetarian. And, you know, that the person in their heart of hearts shouldn't support abortion. So I think by the time I became a mitra, I had slowly turned around from being fed to wanting to train, to want to be an apprentice, to want to give something back in helping order members and by default helping what was then the FWBO to grow. I had by that time joined and lived in the first community that it was ever, I think the first legal community that had ever been established, Maitri Vihara. And I had experienced various ways of meeting those interested in spiritual development, meeting in one-to-ones, meeting in groups, meeting over a meal, meeting in study groups, meeting through various projects. Remember, the first one I got involved with was raising money by doing a long walk over Hampstead Heath, and that was for raising money for converting the old fire station in Bethnal Green, later to become the London Buddhist Centre. Meeting on retreats and meeting at the centre. In these meetings, these times together with newcomers, peer friends and order members, I could notice with a slowly developing awareness the differences, the progression and the change in myself and others, such as the level of engagement, the openness between us, the honesty, the energy, the inspiration, the possibilities for change, and how fixed I was. You know, where was I, you know, where were my resistances to change? Once in the community, I was asked to support an evening class by Loka Mitra, and that was Friends Night, that was Sangha Night. And there I got to appreciate mitras and order members even more. And I valued those that came along. I saw them regularly in that context and sometimes outside of the class. And that regular committed input had a positive effect on the dynamic of the evening, not just from me, but from Ratnaguna and Padmavajra too, you know, the three of us, and I think Maharatna Jyoti was also part of that team. So I was now in the process of moving from being in the receipt of a lot of giving to receiving a little less and giving a little more. And I believe it was in the first year of being in Maitri Vihara that I first saw and heard Bhante. This was at Caxton Hall in Westminster, and he was giving the talk, Enlightenment as Experience and Non-Experience. Christmas Humphreys introduced him for that talk, and I just found it a very interesting introduction and conclusion to the talk. So when I first saw Bhante, it was at the door. He was sitting down talking to an order member called Devaraja. And I was quite struck by him. You know, I was quite struck. You know, he seemed very bright, and I thought, you know, he was a very handsome man. You know, when he was giving the talk, what I noticed was he seemed to have the ability to feel that I was being seen by him, and it was, you know, there were quite a lot there in the hall. I later then met him at Albemarle, which is in Castleacre. I once asked him, with sort of like awe in my eyes and face, you know, well, how come the cottage is called Albemarle? And I was waiting for something maybe from the Greek past or whatever. He said, well, the previous owners are called Albert and Mary. So, times like that, you get the carpet taken from under your feet by Banti in many different ways, and that's one way. I went there that weekend with two friends who knew Banti quite well, and I remember we went to a nearby town. I think it was to buy bread, but in that town there happened to be a second-hand bookshop, and Banti is a great lover of second-hand books, or at least was a great lover of second-hand books till his eyesight started to fail. And what I noticed whilst in that second-hand bookshop and being around Banti, he wasn't right next to me, but I felt really more in touch with my intuition than I'd ever been before. And I felt this sort of intuitive side, this quiet voice, it moved me to buy two important books, one of which had a big effect when I studied architecture. It was a book on Frank Lloyd Wright. The other one was Ruskin's Seven Lamps of Architecture, which I have to admit I haven't read cover to cover, but it remains on my bookshelf. So this experience of being more in touch with myself was not alien. It's not alien. I'm sure for us here, it's not an alien experience to feel this. It's just that there was more intensity and direction to my life. Yeah, it was like being connected to a more creative flow of life, and in that, an alive flow of life. Yeah, this was the beginning of what remains as being one of the two most important friendships of my life to date, the other being my father. In these friendships, and many others, I have what stands out for me as the glue, the substance, the invisible jointing that keeps that gives them life. Yeah. And this is what I see as this glue, this substance, this invisible jointing, is keeping in regular communication with those dear friends and my many other dear friends, keeping in regular communication by giving cards, sending cards, emails, texts, phone calls, and dare I say letters, meeting up. There's nothing more enriching than meeting face to face. I remember a story I asked Banti once about an order member that was going to spend a lot of money on themselves. And I was taking Banti out for a meal at that time to a Chinese restaurant in Knightsbridge. And I said this. And I said, so-and-so's, spend all this money. Couldn't they use it for just taking people out for meals? And Banti, quick as a flash, said, you should be taking people out for meals anyway. whether you've got a whole load of money or not. So meeting up, there are more ways than just having meals. Be generous in all ways, including, gifts, time, interest, give confidence, can't you? There are many ways to be generous. Become more open. Learn to trust one another. Last but not least, bear the friend in mind in a metaphor way. Maybe make it a first thing in the morning practice. I picked up this little practice from Banti again. I asked him one time, I said, Banti, what do you do when you wake first thing in the morning? He said, I think about my friends. So I thought, well, I'll start thinking about my friends. So it started with three or four, and it's grown since then. So it's another way of turning the day around. Just bring your friends to mind. Yeah, metta is a great driver to broaden our circle of friends, whether they become close or not. It's an opportunity to be with the characters, that form the part of the practice, whether it's the friend, the neutral person, or the enemy, or the world. you know, it's helping us connect. And I was thinking just the other day, as I was walking along, how easy it is sometimes, even if there's somebody who you might not know that well, but there's part of you feels, oh, I'm not sure if I like them, to change your pace or to maybe move over to another side of the pavement to give them lots of space, you know, rather than reminding myself of what's important, you know, and that is the goodwill towards, you know, that particular person, you know, sort of watching the boundaries. I'm emphasising friendship and the importance of it in developing Sangha. What I'd like to suggest is that in association with friendships, we could add going for refuge to the three jewels, because as we're moving forward in our spiritual life, it's as though things matter more. You know, our connection with ourself, our lives, our spiritual lives, and our association with others matter more. When we're less in touch with that, and it may be a small thing, like, you know, we've stopped reading Dharma, seeing more movies, or reading short stories, you know, sort of, anyway, trashy novels or whatever. We may notice that the richness isn't there, so it's worth looking at what for us constitutes our going for refuge. Yeah, developing our commitment to honour our spiritual values, which is a bit similar to what I said. And in that, and I was remarking, you know, that Amalekhetu has this quality, when I said something to him becoming chairman the other night, was, you know, in developing our commitment to honour our spiritual values, to have the ability, and this was a value I saw in Amalekhetu, to see things through, you know, to really see things through. And to keep inspired. I've mentioned reading books, but reading Dharma, reading the Dharma, reading suttas. Gyushu Vajra is talking about taking, you know, a sutta, various suttas on solitary retreat with him, and how inspiring he found it. I imagine it took him into the world of the Buddha. So there he was on the edge of the wilderness in South Island, but with the Buddha in his Sangha. I don't know how it affected his dream life, but maybe you'd tell us sometime. Reading Bhante's books. You know, his, because he put so much care into his works. I saw him the other week, and he was talking about the publication Living Ethically, and he said that when he received the first transcript from the Spoken Word Project, he worked on that three times, you know, three different, how do you put it, returns to him. So he saw it first, sent it back, saw it the second time, sent it back, saw it the third time, sent it back, and then it was only after the third time that he agreed for it to be printed. So in reading Dante, you are really reading, you know, what he believes. And, you know, yes, in our lives, persevere, have patience with yourself and others. Be forgiving. I think perseverance is a great quality. You know, it's is one that shows a level of integrity, you know, that you hear of walking the walk, talking the talk, but to do it and stand by it, don't move, even though things may seem to fall apart around you, and they will fall apart around you. Have time, you know, give yourself that patience then when they fall apart, to let them gather, let the new you come together. Yeah. And lastly, as a little tip, this happened quite a few years ago, I was a bit younger, had red hair then, reddish. I was with Bhante in his study in Sukhavati, had a little flat there, and I was sitting on the sofa with him, he was sort of like leaning back, and I was sitting on the edge, and I turned round to him and I said, Bhante, you know, I really do admire you, you know, I really do admire you, and, you know, I'd like to be more like you. You know, what do you think I should do? And it was only seconds before he replied. But I thought, he could say anything. And what he said to me was, take opportunities when they arise. Take opportunities when they arise. And he backed that by saying that he'd been asked when he was living in Kalimpong, whether he would organise the taking round of the relics of Sariputra and Moggallana, who we've heard a bit about last night, to take some of their, imagine, ashes or bits of bone of them that had been given from the British Museum back to India, and there was this procession of these relics where they would go from town to town in the foothills of the Himalayas, and Bhante was asked to organise that trip, and he said I hadn't organised anything in my life before, but he said yes, he would do it. And if you read that little episode in one of his memoirs, I think you'll find that it was quite a successful trip. They would be left in one particular town overnight, or maybe several days, for people to worship them. So take opportunities when they arise. And I'm sure we can look back in our lives and see that there have been many a time where we've lost opportunities. Well, now's the time to draw a line under that and say, look, that's the past. The future is, I'm going to take opportunities when they arise. And obviously ones that you could see as skillful. There are lots of opportunities, but it's the skillful ones. And we are talking about developing Sangha. So talking of drawing a line... So we're here today because of the dedication, effort and inspiration of many order members, mitras and friends. In fact, I must point to Guhya Vajra for his efforts in helping build Padmaloka, rebuild Padmaloka and add to Padmaloka. As an exemplar of somebody who has put himself out wholeheartedly many a time for the movement, not in just in building work but in putting the Dharma over. So we're here today because of the dedication, effort and inspiration of many order members, mitras and friends. All have and continue to develop the Sangha through our centres, retreat centres, right livelihoods, through Buddha Field and other activities. All have been inspired by Bhante Sangharakshita. I was inspired by Subhuti, inspired by him, to move to Colchester in Essex. After visiting the town once a week for 3 years, I started in 1988. A chap called Kelvin Youngs, who's now called Bodhivaksa, invited me to run a 6-week meditation and Buddhism course at Friends Meeting House. And I just kept on going. My brother was coming along, and I enjoyed meditating with my brother, but I also enjoyed the opportunity to do something more with my life. I'd got to a point in my life where things were just a little bit grey. I don't know if you know that feeling. Things are just a little bit safe. I'd been ordained 6 years, And I was actively involved with the London Buddhist Centre, fronting it in any administrative role, but I was actively involved in it. I was running a right livelihood, but there was something missing. So Bodhivaksa, or Kelvin as he was then, hit the mark. He invited me to take the six-week course, and I just kept going every week after that. I sometimes wondered why, but I did. And then in 1991, sitting in what is now the Wild Cherry with Subhuti, I was wondering what to do with my future, because when Bodhivaksa, Samantha Badri, as she is now, said, one day when you move to Colchester, I'd say I'm not moving to Colchester, I moved to somewhere like Australia or America or Canada. So we're like that. So, but anyway, with Subhuti of the Wild Cherry, I said, what do you think I should do? And he said, move to Colchester, move everything to Colchester, which I did. And it was a very good move. But before I went, I went to see Bhante and I asked him, did he have any new tips on developing Sangha? Did he have any new tips on developing Sangha? He said, no. Yeah? He had no new tips on developing Sangha. He said it was by friendship that he had built the FWBO and the WBO, now the Tri Ratna Buddhist community and the Tri Ratna Buddhist order. He'd built it on friendship. However, he also added that in moving there, I could not do everything on my own. Yeah? That it's important that I had support from others in activities, in future activities in Colchester. You know, I not only had that support from people in Colchester, I also had it from visiting order members. Friends of mine would come to give talks and lead events. Arthur Darshan came one year to lead Padmasambhava Day. I had it from the, you know, from places like Padmaloka too and Taraloka for the women. In those days, the forward moving, the moving outwards, the sort of expansion of the order was really, you know, there was a buzz about it. And I'm sure, you know, it will happen again. Maybe it will happen one day soon. So when women and men went to, women to Taraloka, men to Padmaloka, they were from Colchester, they were just so warmly received and, you know, they'd always come back saying what a fantastic time they'd had. And I'm sure it's the same for others who came from other centres, but it meant more to me there. It meant more when they'd come back with those stories. Okay. So those two bits of advice of, you know, the Sangha is built on friendship and also not to do it all on my own. I moved my Right Livelihood business and myself to Colchester. And I started a weekly class and a men's group to make up for the community, Sukhavati community, that I'd left. I left a community of myself and 15 other men. And the rest, you know, the rest of that story of what happened in Colchester is, you know, for another time, another talk. But I will say, you know, it was one of the best things I've ever done in my life, if not the best thing I've ever done in my life to date. Yeah, moving to Colchester, and yeah, I'm very, very proud of the Colchester Buddhist Centre. Okay. So. A week past Monday, I said I met Bhante recently. I went to Birmingham with a dear friend, Amoghavadra, to see Bhante. And we had a very enjoyable meeting with him. The two of us swam for about 45 minutes. And I let Bhante know that I was giving this talk. And was there any emphasis he would like to give on developing Sangha? And his response was, he said, developing Sangha starts with people. Then, from this grows spiritual friendship. And this spiritual friendship involves seeing people. And seeing them regularly, yeah? And seeing people is based on a mutual interest in the Dharma and engaging in Dharma activities, such as meditating together, studying together, and puja together. So he said, developing Sangha starts with people, then from this grows spiritual friendship. This involves seeing people and seeing them regularly. Seeing people is based on a mutual interest in the Dharma and engaging in Dharma activities, such as meditating together, studying together, and puja together. This is what he said. But my notes also show that he pointed to his talk, The Mystery of Human Communication. It's talk 149, if you want the detail. The Mystery of Communication. I don't know if it had a direct tie into what I had asked, but as I was writing this talk, those words, The Mystery of Human Communication, seemed to resonate all the way back through the ages to the time the Buddha met his five ascetic friends again at Saranath. From this meeting and the days that followed, the Sangha was established and grew, fueled by the Dharma and inspired by the Buddha. His communication would have been amazing to be in receipt of and behold. Yeah? What a man to have met. However, we are fortunate to be here some 2,500, 2,600 years on from that time. We are the inheritors of such wealth. Wealth made clear and inspiring by Bhante and other translators. Do we store this wealth, or do we share this wealth? In sharing it, we too might find the joy, the inspiration, and the spiritual growth in the act of developing Sangha. Thank you.